Once while our whole family was visiting Aunt Rafola for several weeks of summer holidays, we had a visit from a gentleman who had spent many years traveling in the Far East, and who, as Uncle Ferdinand informed us, could tell all kinds of interesting stories about these faraway places. We children were introduced to the man and, as usual, our parents told him what we could do. Aunt Rafola laughingly told him about my remarkable habit of assuming strange, leg-twisting postures which nobody else could imitate, except perhaps an India rubber man. I lay down on the floor, and as I was always embarrassed when people were talking about me, feeling uncomfortable about merely protruding above ground, I assumed a position in which I could completely conceal my head, giving spectators the illusion of its having been cut off. The grown-ups laughed. Then I demonstrated a few other difficult postures that I enjoyed so much. Our strange guest watched my performance for a while without cracking a smile and finally burst out in astonishment. "But this child is doing typical yoga exercises. Where did you learn them, little girl?" He turned to me. I did not know what the word yoga meant, so I answered that no one had shown me these exercises and that I did them just because I liked them and felt better afterwards. The man refused to believe it, looking at me long and inquiringly, and shaking his head. The grown-up's questions had already begun to bore me, so when Mother waved us off, we disappeared into the children's room, and I promptly forgot the remarks made by our distinguished visitor. Only much, much later, when the memory suddenly came to life and I began to understand many other things which had been obscure and inscrutable in my life, I remembered the remarks of the widely traveled gentleman from the Far East. Then I understood where I had learned these physical postures which I had practiced as a child and later as an adult. Postures our distinguished visitor had called yoga exercises. Then I realized clearly that I had done these exercises out of long-standing habit, because I had been obliged to practice them daily in the temple year after year. These exercises were a reflection of my past and at the same time the shadow of events yet to come in my life, for much later, as an adult, I taught these exercises to many people in order to further their mental and physical development. Struggles of love. The years passed rapidly. As I grew, my body began to mature. I enjoyed reading books that dealt with love stories and problems of love, so I delved deeper and deeper into my personality. I looked forward into the future and determined to find a noble-spirited husband who would understand me perfectly. In this way I began to concern myself less with books and more with young people, later with young men. The young men were also interested in me. Mother tried in vain to bring me up as a modest young lady. Even in my earliest years I had to realize that I possessed a power of attraction. However, in my blindness, I considered that this power which drew so many people towards me was an attractiveness emanating from my person. We always have to pay for our spiritual deficiencies, and because of my being blinded to the truth at this age, I was later to have to pay the price of almost becoming physically blind. I had yet to learn that my power of attraction was not intended to serve my private life, but rather to lead the people following me along the path of their salvation. At that time, however, my whole thinking centered around my personality, and I believed I would find my highest happiness in the love of man and wife. I thus went through many of the experiences that usual in this world. I was loved and fell in love, but all my joys and sorrows were merely a prelude to my later destiny. A relationship with one man in particular dominated the 6 years of my life from the age of 13 until I was 19, and looking at it in retrospect, I would call this whole experience a training school for the development of unusually strong willpower. My destiny knew that I was going to need this weapon in life. When I was 13, I met a young man whose brilliant traits made him stand out high above the average. His character was made up of a purposeful and determined striving for the highest and finest and most beautiful things in life, combined with an almost pathologically acute egotism and desire for power. He loved me, so he said, but he loved himself and wanted to make me his obedient slave. He recognized very early that we both had the same spiritual viewpoint and that art meant the same to me as it did to him. This led him to believe that he had found in me a partner worthy of himself. He hoped, in time, to make me over into his own image, a highly cultured but absolutely obedient wife. He thought he would do away completely with my independent thinking. He brought me excellent books about art, the history of art, music, world history, the best works of literature, both modern and classical, and he insisted that I read these works in the original. Since I found learning languages just for their own sake extremely boring, he took the time to learn languages with me. Then he sought out the best piano teacher for me. In short, he did everything imaginable to help me get an unusually good education. Mother saw in him a helpful angel for my education, because languages were really hard for me. The best tutors tried in vain to teach me. I refused to learn long lists of words by heart. This young man brought me German, French, and English newspapers, magazines, and theatrical works, then read them with me, thus helping me to work my way into various languages. That was very helpful and certainly all to the good, but along with his helpfulness he kept trying consistently and purposefully to force me under his domination. Shortly after we got acquainted, he said that I was going to become his wife and he wanted me to consider myself as his property. Everything I wanted to read I had to show him first to get his permission. He refused to let me make friends with anybody at all without his prior permission. Like other young girls, I went to a dancing school with my sister. I was passionately fond of dancing and equally fond of having a good time with the other young people in the class. I also enjoyed ice skating. None of these things had any appeal for him. But I was young and I wanted to dance and skate and have a good time with other young people. This made him jealous, and to a degree far surpassing anything one might consider normal. Worst of all, his jealousy went hand in hand with an almost insatiable desire for power. At first I was flattered that a man who was so well known and highly esteemed by so many people should have chosen a little girl like me as his future wife. He was a brilliant talker, and quite often I enjoyed conversations with him tremendously. I was also pleased that he took the same profound and serious views of friendship and love that I did. On the other hand, when I began to feel he was systematically and consistently trying to force his will upon me, more and more, like a band of steel, all his attentions became annoying. A struggle began, a terrible struggle between the invisible forces of two souls. The more he felt I was growing out of his power, the more firmly he sought to hold me. When I was 17, he wanted us to announce our engagement publicly. He sent his father to visit mine. My father was not exactly delighted. A long time afterwards, he told me he had never been impressed by my fiancé's aggressive approach, but he didn't want to interfere with our free will. He respected everybody's right to make up his own mind, including his own children, and so he gave his consent, even though reluctantly. I hoped my fiancé's jealousy would die down after our betrothal. As time went on, however, and my body continued to develop in form and charm, his jealousy knew no bounds, and he often made terrible scenes. After torturing me for hours, he often went to the opposite extreme, asked me for forgiveness on his knees, cried like a baby, begged for my love, and promised never to torture me again. I found such scenes absolutely unbearable. Never before in my young life had I experienced any such thing. My father possessed tremendous power, a kind of power which he radiated about him automatically and unintentionally. He never tried to force his will upon others. He liked to leave everybody his freedom and never expected others to follow and obey him blindly. At that time he was holding a top-level position, and my little girl wish had already been fulfilled for quite a period. He no longer had a manager or director supervising him. Even so, he was never domineering or tyrannical towards his subordinates. He was like a tower of strength for all around him, both at home and in his office. Hundreds of subordinates and all our relatives sought his counsel. He was just, generous, and always ready to help. No wonder I had grown up thinking that all men were like him. At home I had never known such things as egotism and unscrupulousness, and my sister and I had both grown up in a healthy atmosphere of true, selfless love. I could not have known what sadism and masochism were any more than I could have understood, let alone bear, all the quarrels I got involved in with my fiancé. I wanted to be free. Free. For a long time, however, I could not resist his will. An innate propensity towards faithfulness, together with an understanding approach towards the weaknesses of other people, also kept me for quite a time from taking action. But my willpower developed with the years, and all of a sudden I began to ask myself why I should go on enduring this torture. One day I told him I wanted to be free. He would not hear of it. We struggled desperately, for his will still held me in a grip of steel. The longer I struggled, the more my willpower developed, until finally it was greater than his. The moment finally came when I had enough courage to tell him I no longer wanted to be his wife. More stormy scenes followed, but their effect was completely lost on me. I was sorry for him, but at the same time I had lost all respect for him because of his behavior, so domineering and tyrannical on the one hand, and so extremely cowardly on the other. In those days I did not know that these two characteristics are very closely related, so closely in fact as to be two complementary aspects of the same disease. On the other hand, I felt him to be sick in his soul, and I wanted absolutely to be free. With a last great effort I shook off his will. I spoke to my parents. They were not surprised. And one fine afternoon when I was 19 I set out on a journey with my cousin to his mother, my father's sister, beautiful Aunt Ray Fuller. I broke my engagement. First encounter with death ever since my childhood days, I had often become pale and tired around springtime. In most cases, the best remedy was to visit my Aunt Ray Fuller. She lived in the mountains with her family, and the combination of the bracing mountain air and the atmosphere of wisdom and religion these people lived in always cured me very quickly. I felt very happy in these quiet and noble surroundings and would come home, fresh and full of new energy and vitality. After my engagement had been dissolved, I went again to see my aunt. At that time, she was already a widow and was living with her daughter. She welcomed me with great affection, and I fully enjoyed the long-desired peace and tranquility. I felt like a kite with a broken string, soaring up into infinity. What a wonderful spring it was! As usual, my aunt understood me perfectly. She expressed her views upon my decision with great insight. Afterwards, she never mentioned the matter again. In her home I lived in absolute freedom. She let me come and go as I liked. I could roam through the hills and woods and enjoy nature to the full. During this period when I felt completely happy in my freedom and looked towards the future with confidence, I encountered death for the first time in my life. While hiking one day I came to a field of grain. As my plans for marriage had recently been blasted, I stopped there and tried to picture my future. First of all, I was going to be a pianist, I told myself, like my grandmother. Then I get married to a healthy, happy, normal husband and have children. Then the children would grow up, and I might even have grandchildren. And then what? Then I'd grow old. And then? Then one day I'd have to die. Death. That is the end, the aim, the direction in which we all go. But why? Why all this trouble? Why should I practice at my piano and become a great artist? Does it really make any difference, whether these bones, covered with skin, ever glide over the keys with great proficiency? If human beings have to die anyway someday, does it matter what they have made out of their lives? Whether they have been famous and brilliant or unknown and unrecognized, whether they have been honest or dishonest? Why struggle, toil, bear children, suffer and be happy, joyful and sorrowful, when the ultimate end is death and destruction? It would surely be much easier to die right away. This thought was so terrible, so unbearable, that the world around me became dark and void. I leaned against a tree and gazed down into the valley, upon the town, the endless houses with the many human beings who lived in them. From up here they looked like tiny ants. All those beings lived, fought, struggled for love and money, all of them had their problems, their cross to bear, they took everything so desperately seriously. But why? Why, when life is but a fleeting moment, when death is waiting at the end, solving all problems, terminating all suffering and all joy? What are we running after? What do we attain? Death. Whether we are happy or unhappy, a king or a beggar, the end for all of us is death. Panic gripped me. No. I won't go through with it. I cannot learn, love and live with this thought. Everything is senseless. I would rather commit suicide right now so that I won't have to die at the end of my life. A devilish, sarcastic voice laughed in my ear. Ha ha ha. That's really like you to be so stupid. You want to kill yourself, so you won't have to die? Do you really think you can escape death? You are here, here on earth in a body. You cannot just flee from here without death. If you kill yourself, the end, from which you wished to save yourself only a moment ago, will be imminent. Instantaneous death. Not just someday far away, but right here and now. Do you understand? As long as you are here, in your body, you cannot get away unless you die. You are a prisoner. Do you understand? A prisoner. Only through the portals of death can you be released from your body. You cannot escape death. You cannot escape. Ha ha ha. I tried to gather my scattered thoughts. Yes, it was true, I was in a trap and suicide would not help matters. It would only take me right into what I was anxious to avoid. So now what? In any case, I could take momentary comfort in the fact that I was still very young, and that death was still probably far away. I was healthy. All my ancestors had reached a great age. These facts gave me new courage. By the time I get old, I thought, a lot can still happen. The scientists, who constantly discover new things about life, will someday certainly discover the secret of immortality. I clung to this thought, and gained the incentive and the energy to go on living, working and wishing. I was absolutely right. Immortality was discovered, only I did not know at the time, that this discovering of immortality was really something I would have to do for myself to find out that death does not exist, and that all human beings, myself included, are and always will be immortal. For everyone must discover immortality in himself and for himself. No other person can pass this truth on to him. If somebody does not believe a truth, even a perfectly obvious fact, it simply does not exist for him no matter how many other people have discovered it already. Every human being must recognize the fact that death is nothing but life itself and that man not only does not have to die, but is not even able to die. It is absolutely impossible. At that time, I knew nothing of all this. To me, death was a big, black wall against which I had cracked my head with considerable force. Nevertheless, I was young, and so I calmed down as well as I could. I postponed the whole thing and decided, as far as humanly possible, not to think about the problem of death. Such thoughts would only weaken me, and I preferred to make plans for the future. In normal circumstances, I was used to doing everything on my own and upon my own initiative. My father had never concerned himself with the personal affairs of his children. His profession occupied him to such an extent, that he had never had time to interest himself in what went on in his family. We usually only met at the family table, where I never mentioned the scenes which occurred between myself and my fiancé. My mother loved me, as she loved all her children, but she only began to understand me much later on, when we said goodbye to each other for good. At that time, she wanted me to become as efficient a housewife and mother as she herself was. I myself regarded this as the central aim of my life, but the way in which I wanted to achieve it was quite different from the one she envisaged. The path of my life could be only my own, and I could not accept the advice she gave me in respect to my future. Mother wanted me to prepare myself for the role of the gentle little mother, whereas I, with every drop of my blood, sought fulfillment in music and art. I was therefore left completely to my own devices and gradually got used to thinking and acting independently as far as this was possible in the family circle. I therefore tried to picture a future completely on my own, without asking anyone for advice. I decided to continue my studies at the Music Academy, and passed the final examinations so as to get a diploma. Father often said to us, "Don't be blind to the vagaries of faith just because everything is going well at present. Earthly riches can be destroyed. Whatever knowledge you acquire is yours to keep and cannot be taken away from you. Learn as much as you can, and at least get a diploma of some sort. If things go well, you can leave it in a drawer, but if you run into hard times, you can earn your living with it. Oh my father, you wonderful, unselfish, wise man. This piece of advice was the greatest treasure among all those you ever passed on to me. At that time, none of us could imagine how we could ever get into any difficulties and believed in secret that you were just talking like a strict pedagogue. How often I remembered this advice during the war when everything we owned was destroyed and I was stranded with a gravely wounded, disabled husband. We were saved by what I had learnt, by what I carried in me, what I knew. For all our outward possessions were lost. As I stood there that day on the mountain, a young, inexperienced girl, thinking about my future, I had no idea what fate held in store for me. But I felt I had to follow your advice. And so, when I got back home that summer and started a fresh page of my life, the most important thing was to concentrate all my energy on acquiring a piano teacher's diploma. Everything else I left in the hands of destiny. First visions of the future. During the 6 years I was engaged, something happened that was so surprising and so impressive it had an effect on the direction all my later life was to take. Through it my attention was guided towards a world lying hidden deep within the human being, the unknown, unconscious world of the human self. I was 15 years old when I discovered that I was sometimes able to see the future in dreams, very precisely, as if what I was seeing were a faithful reproduction of reality. What occurred then happened again later at various times and still happens today, always in the same manner. At first my dream runs through all kinds of chaotic and irrelevant pictures. Then suddenly, as if a curtain were pushed to one side, I see colorful, plastic and logically connected pictures, with absolute clarity just as in real life. In that first clear dream of the future I saw, in my parents' bathroom, a young man holding a newborn baby. The baby was all blue, as if suffocated, and the young man was trying to get it to breathe. A woman assistant stood beside him, ready to help. The child was not breathing. The doctor held it first under ice-cold water, then under hot water. Then he held it head downward and swung it to and fro. When it finally let out a cry, all of us round about heaved a sigh of relief. From where he stood in the doorway further now ran to mother's room, fell down on his knees beside her bed, laid his head on the edge of the bed near mother and sobbed as I had never seen this strong man sob before in all my life. Mother was very pale, but she smiled tenderly and stroked father's black hair. Father calmed down after a while, got up and went into the next room where Aunt Rafila and her daughter were waiting to be able to visit mother. Curiously enough, in my dream I was able to look into all rooms simultaneously, which of course would have been impossible in reality. Another thing that struck me was that the young man, after turning the baby over to his assistant, came out of the bathroom, walking with a peculiar gliding gait. I also noticed his pretty, curly, blonde hair, and very distinctly I heard him say, "Mother and child are out of danger but need absolute quiet. If anybody comes to visit them, I cannot take the responsibility for any infection that may occur during this present condition of weakness." "Of course, doctor," answered Aunt Rafila. And I saw how she very sensibly took her leave and went away with her daughter. Then the picture blacked out, and I awoke. The next morning I ran to mother and told her my dream. Mother laughed and said, "Please don't dream things like that, I have enough children. And what is Aunt Rafila doing in this dream?" She doesn't even live here. And who is the handsome young man with the gliding gait and the curly blonde hair? You're dreaming like this about good-looking young men seems very suspicious to me. I don't know who he is, mother, but I saw him just that way in my dream. Later, at lunchtime, we all discussed my strange dream for a while, but by the next day nobody gave it another thought. A year later, mother felt very ill. She could not eat and the doctors suspected she might have a duodenal ulcer. They x-rayed her and made other examinations. The result? No exact diagnosis. Our doctor advised mother to see a famous gynecologist. After his examination, the old professor said, "Congratulations. The end of this great sickness will be a baptism." He laughed gently. Mother came home in desperation. She was already 39 years old. Little by little she calmed down, however, and 6 months later, exactly a year after my dream, when no one could have believed that we would have another addition to the family, the little baby arrived. The old professor recommended a young doctor who had already gained a great reputation for his skill. When the baby was born, it seemed to be dead of suffocation. It was 20 long minutes before it took its first breath. Father was so exhausted from the protracted worry that, when the danger was over, he sank to his knees beside mother's bed and, strong man that he was, sobbed like a baby. Aunt Trefola and her daughter were visiting us briefly en route to Italy. They spent 2 days with us, and the child was born just as they were ready to go on. They waited in the next room, and when father came in to say that all was safely over, Aunt Trefola asked whether she might see mother and child before her departure. Then the young doctor came into the room. He had curly blonde hair and a peculiar gliding gait. He then said exactly, word for word, what I had heard him say in my vision. Indeed, everything happened exactly as I had already experienced it. It was as if I had seen part of a motion picture a long time before the other events in the film and completely separate from them. From then on I often saw future events, as dream pictures, with precise details. At first this experience always came to me in dreams. Every time it was as if a curtain were being shoved to one side. Later, however, I was able to enter this state intentionally, by an act of will, without being asleep. But this only came much later. My new baby sister was almost like a granddaughter in the family. Greet was then 19, I 16, and my brother 9 years old. She was everybody's little darling. But the attention she received pushed us two older children pretty far into the background, and we often found ourselves alone. For several years, only our governess accompanied us when we went skating and to concerts and parties. Mother was just as busy with our new little sister as she had been 9 years before when my brother was born. No wonder that they had no time to bother about my affairs, even when they noticed I was having disputes with my fiancé. I had to fight my battle alone, without help. The past awakens. When I left Aunt Trefola's and returned home following the breaking off of my engagement, summer had come. I was 19 years old and wanted to enjoy my freedom. At last I could see other young people without having to risk a terrible scene from my jealous fiancé. On my return, I went straight to the local tennis courts. On the first day, I met a very attractive, trim-looking young man. His bearing and manner were most charming. He had a good-looking head on his shoulders, a well-built, slim, muscular body and always turned up in faultless white tennis slacks and jersey. I took to him from the first moment, and he seemed to like me too. On our third day, one of our teammates rather unhappily cracked her racket over the head of our ball boy. He began to cry bitterly. The sympathetic young man threw his racket away, ran up to the little boy, took him onto his lap, and started to comfort him. He did not seem to mind the boy's dirtying his immaculate tennis clothes at all. He stroked his head, dried his tears, and gave him some money. In a matter of moments the boy started to smile through his tears and ran off to the counter to buy some sweets. My heart went out to him. Are there really such young men, I thought, who have a little compassion? I began to love him. In the following winter, I became engaged to him. We loved one another deeply and passionately, and I could hardly wait for the moment when I was to become his wife with body and soul, with every part of my being. My father wanted me to finish my studies before my marriage, and I still had 1 year left to go at the music academy.